This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Welcome back, everybody, to the People Speak Radio Show. I'm your host for tonight, Steve Johnson. The People Speak Show normally airs every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific and 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network. You can participate during the show with call-in questions for our guests, toll-free in Canada on the USA on 1-888-429-5471. Or you can join us live in the government politics section of Pal Talk, the largest free chat program in the world, where we have our virtual radio room, the People Speak Show, where anyone may participate during the show. This is a fantastic show tonight. I'm more excited than Trump's campaign manager getting a gig on Oprah. We're talking to a very special guest right here, a 9/11 researcher for over a decade, having helped produce the 9/11 documentary, Loose Change, and responsible for independent research leading to the Hollow Towers theory of how and what happened to the Twin Towers on 9/11. He also runs the Let's Roll Forums at www.letsrollforums.com, where he encourages everyone to join, observe, and participate with the end goal of sharing research, opinions, and information on 9/11. We're talking tonight to Mr. Phil Jahan and his associate, Larry McWilliams, about the Twin Towers and casting a closer eye on what really happened on September the 11th, 2001. Welcome back to the People Speak Show, Mr. Jahan and Mr. Larry McWilliams, sir.
Great to be here tonight. Glad to be back.
Excellent. It's great to have you. It certainly is. Yeah, we'll be taking audience questions after the first half hour. But my first question to you tonight is, can you tell me a little bit more about the smoke machine research that you discovered at Ground Zero?
Are you talking about the link that I sent you?
Yes, sir. Yeah, a little bit more about that.
Well, there's a couple of different, you know, varieties of obscurance, you know, fake smoke that they, you know, used on 9/11. For TV viewers, you know, they actually had digitally overlaid, you know, the smoke, the thick black, you know, hazy smoke coming out of the World Trade Center. You know, did you see the second link that I sent you, Steve? The one, you know, that showed the loops of smoke?
The one direct to the forums, yes. I saw the forum link, and I also saw on your own website, philjahan.wordpress.com.
Yeah, there's, you know, this isn't something that we actually discovered. We just discovered it out on the net. This was somebody else's research. But,
okay.
You know, they actually, you know, in real time, they were adding to what was actually happening at Ground Zero. They actually digitally overlaid, you know, smoke coming from the World Trade Center, you know, which wasn't real. Hey, Larry, do you want to add to that?
Well, I do, yes. And one of the things Phil was the first one to notice is in some of the footage, some of the close-ups, in some ways, they made mistakes with the close-ups. They assumed nobody would be looking critically, but in several instances, you can identify. We called them ninjas because they were like stagehands, dressed in all black, and often even had a hood, so that they would blend into the dark background and the windows behind them. But you can actually observe someone extend out the window and adjust a pipe, which is billowing smoke. It's producing smoke coming out of the end of the pipe. You can actually watch the gentleman extend out the window and adjust the pipe so that the smoke's going exactly the way he wants it. And I think in the one shot, and this is both video and stills, but in the one shot, you can identify five of these individual pipes that are and that's not the row of pipes that you see from a distance, the row of smoke and that was in a straight line. That was the, you know, it was spread out all across the upper parts of the towers, those little smoke pipes, and apparently they were you can even witness them being adjusted in one piece of video. There were even several smoke machines identified at the Pentagon. Early on, as the fire brigades are arriving at the Pentagon, in the little fenced-in yard or in close proximity to it, where there's no smoke and no fire, all at once, something fires up and a great big production of smoke begins from this apparatus, which is not, it's clearly not coming from the building when you see it start up.
Yeah, it actually looks like one of the fence posts at the Pentagon. It looks like, you know, something, and it comes out. It's a military obscurant. I mean, it comes out fast, thick, and heavy, and it's shooting upward, you know, at, you know, tremendous speeds, producing a huge amount of kind of like a whitish, ashen color smoke. But it certainly is a smoke machine.
And it brings us back to the point of logic that I made last week. If you have real fires, why would you have a ninja adjusting pipes producing extra smoke? If you had a real incident at the Pentagon, why would you have a giant smoke machine obscuring it with a huge cloud of smoke?
These things were like Hollywood prop machines, basically set up to produce more smoke and mirrors for the event. Do you believe that's what the intention was?
Correct, absolutely. They knew that they had to have something for eyewitnesses to see so that they could say, oh, yeah, we saw smoke coming from the building. Absolutely, we did. So there had to be some production. And again, it takes us back to the gelatin bee. It would seem, from what we know about the gelatin bee thing, that was some sort of visual rehearsal. It was photographed from the helicopter, and it would seem like it was the type of dress rehearsal to get a gauge for how far away things should be shot and what the perception would be in reality when these stunts were pulled off. But again, if we have a handful of fake victims, why do we need those if there are real victims? Why do we need smoke machines if there are real fires in the building? The basic logic that it begs is pretty huge.
Yeah, I wanted to talk to you about the fake victims thing. You believe some of these people were actually simulated victims or Vic Sims, so much the same that the Simon Shack sort of says about?
Well, I don't know if we're exactly on the same page as Simon. Simon would prefer to believe that everything and everyone was fake. The fact is, I started a thread on the forums where we discussed Operations Northwoods was a teaching tool and kind of a trial and error, but they were going to use all students, college students, just presumably traveling to a sporting event or something like that to be shot down. They got much smarter. They knew that if they had just one sort of construction, that it would be easily found out. So it seemed that the victims were a mix of Operation Northwood's total creations, fabrications, who never existed, people who certainly did exist, and who all seemed to be extremely well connected, it seemed there were, of course, a lot of people who did exist who were associated with the Pentagon, and a lot of people who didn't exist associated with the Pentagon. They seem to have mixed up the victim list out of, I think we kind of, Phil can correct me if I'm wrong, I think we came up with about 13 different categories that comprised the total group of victims. Some were obvious spooks who had been disappeared and relocated. They drew on many different avenues to construct the victim list so that one set rule, I hate to use the word debunk, but one debunk would not work for all of the victims. As soon as you say, like Simon would, that they're all fake, then I'll show you one who certainly did exist. And they'll say, so see there. So anybody who assumes that they're all the same then can be easily shot down.
Right, right. I tend to think also that there are some people on that list that were basically wanted to disappear as well, that is possibly still alive.
Correct. If you were, say, you had terminal cancer, and I mean, you knew you were well connected and knew this operation was going down, you could die a hero instead of just dying. If you were, say, maybe, you know, had plenty of reasons, you know, we've done a great deal of research on the fire department, because people say, well, how could this be with the fire department in New York? Well, you know, we have 100% certain evidence of staged photographs involving injured firefighters and firefighters' deaths. Kevin Shea and Michael Judge being two cases in point.
Yeah.
But we also have a great deal of evidence showing that, you know, the firefighters are complicit, and part of that goes straight back to that. Let's say the upper management went to the chiefs and said, "Do you have somebody in your battalion who's unhappy at home? You know, maybe in financial trouble, a gambling debt, you know, maybe some things like that. They just wouldn't mind relocating." Well, what if these guys were put on a list and offered a golden witness relocation program? You'll get your family will be taken care of with the victim's fund. You get your big payoff. You go start a new life on your yacht in the Bahamas or what have you. And you know, it was clear that it seemed like some of the list was populated that way.
I've seen some of the research.
So many options.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, there were. Go ahead.
There was one fella. It's been so long, I don't even remember his name, but he was a banker who had swindled, I don't know, $15 million or so from the central bank in Indonesia. He disappeared, I believe, in Singapore and went missing prior to 9/11. And his son was on Flight 175. You know, this is like an example of what you said, somebody who wanted to disappear, you know, be together with his father who was on the lam.
And let's face it, the government relocates people all the time with a new identity, a new income, a new career, and a new life. It's not a new business for them to get into. It's run of the mill every day.
So I even saw some of these victims. You actually looked at their EXIF data in the actual images that we used. It seems most of these images were pre-concocted on the day of 9/11. Is that not true? You found some evidence of that?
You mean on 9/11? There's one that I know that was concocted on 9/11. David H. Rice. He worked at on the 104th floor. I think it was at McClellan. The exit data on his picture is 9/11/2001. You know, if you really look at that and, you know, understand what you're looking at, you know, it's incredible. It means that the reporter that got that picture, you know, would have had to have known that he died, you know, before midnight on 9/11, contacted the family and asked them for a really good picture for the memorial, which didn't exist yet.
That's more or less pre-constructing the victims beforehand. Is that not right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Mark Bingham's picture. You know, do you remember who Mark Bingham is?
Yeah, you believe me, don't you, Mom? I'm Mark. You believe me, don't you, Mom?
Yeah, that's the guy. His picture, the exit data on Mark's picture, is 8/31/2001. You know, like,
wow.
13 days prior to 9/11.
And of course, that includes the caption, "Victim of 9/11." You know, whichever.
Yeah,
you're saying that they put in the metadata for an image 13 days before 9/11 that he was a victim already on the day of 9/11.
Right.
Wow.
And they told on themselves more in that way on more levels as well. For instance, the tale of Ruth Clifford McCourt and her brother Ronnie McCourt and Paige Hackle, her best friend, and her daughter Juliana. And it's a convoluted story I won't get into, but
yes,
the the story, including correspondence with relatives in Ireland and relatives in several cities in the United States, as well as, you know, gathering the information itself, appeared in the September 12th USA Today.
Goodness.
Well, you know, the USA Today has to go out on the wire to be printed in regional locations at, you know, a very, very early hour of the morning. And so we're to believe that, you know, this happened at, you know, 10 o'clock one morning, and that within literally 12 hours, a huge story was gathered with a dozen witnesses or so on several continents. And it's just, some of it was just way too fast. I mean, besides knowing the names of the 19 fictitious hijackers.
Yes, of course. Can you just to let the audience know, Mark Bingham was a victim of the Flight 93. Is that correct? And who was Mark Bingham, and why was his audio so very interesting? Can you tell a little bit more to the audience?
Well, Mark Bingham was the big hero in 9/11. He's you know, one of the people on Flight 93 who led the Let's Roll battle cry.
He's the Let's Roll guy.
Yeah, and you know, he talked to his mother, Alice Hoagland, on the phone, like you mentioned earlier. And, you know, he gets her on the phone, and he says, you know, "Mom, this is Mark Bingham. You know, you believe me, don't you?" It was just a ridiculous way to start a phone call. And, you know, it just shows some of the pre-scripting errors that, you know, existed in 9/11. You know, things that they could really never change. You know, they were there, they were locked into it. And, I mean, it's such a ridiculous, you look at that and you just, you know, unless you look at it as a scripting error, there's no other way to make sense of Mark doing that with his mom. But yeah, his picture was, you know, created, you know, 8/31, you know, 2001, you know, 12, 13 days prior to 9/11. And there's 50 other people at the Pentagon who, you know, were all created on 2/15/2000. Now, as Larry said, that's complete with the captions, you know, saying who they were and how they died. You know, because from our understanding, if you go in and change the metadata on these pictures, like in your own program, and, you know, save the picture, you know, that now the new picture being taken day, you know, it'll change to today. So every time you edit the picture, the last time you edit the picture is when the picture was taken. You following me?
Yeah, the creation date.
Right. So if you and me take a picture of you or me, and we put a little white sidebar on the side that says, you know, Army Times, you know, military, you know, picture, Pentagon picture, family photo, and it's this little 4-pixel white sidebar. We add that to the picture. Now, today becomes, you know, the picture being taken day for that picture. So if you have a file folder with, you know, 48 or 50 people from the Pentagon, you know, with their exit data showing, you know, 2/15/2000, that means that that's the last time that those pictures were edited in any way.
It seems to me what you guys have come across is some kick-ass, irrefutable forensic evidence of pre-planned production of the false flag event of 9/11.
Well, yeah, on many fronts. And Mark Bingham, of course, and his mother, Alice Hoagland, bring us to yet another of those fronts, which, of course, Mrs. Hoagland's performance on Larry King on the night of 9/11 puts her not at the top of the bad actors of 9/11. But it kind of puts her in the same league with the Sandy Hook dad who kind of was smiling before he was supposed to speak and gave the gig away when she just giggled and chuckled at her son's death that day on Larry King that evening. But the list of actors are very long. Of course, the Harley guy, Bill Heitman. If you've ever, you can look on the forums and do a Google search. Let's Roll. Forums, Bill Heitman, And you can go to the video of Bill Heitman, a very, very bad actor, and it's obvious to anyone that sees it that he is indeed an actor. And again, back to that same point of logic, if you have real witnesses, why would you have actors?
That's a very good point. There's been some research done by a guy called Jeff Hill, who put out 9/11 Amateur, who suggested the people who put in the eyewitness accounts on the video camera as well. A lot of these people were connected to the TV networks. Is that not true? Do you know much about that?
Well, of course they were. Yeah, I mean, but the whole idea is that the majority of the footage caught on 9/11 would be caught by people that are quote-unquote off work, you know, just passerbys, but still part of the news establishment. You know, thus, you know, making their footage proprietary. And the same thing with the other way that they established other avenues of the day, like with the Nade brothers. You know, they were choreographed in to give us some insight into the inside of the towers and to show, you know, that aspect of it, you know, with the firemen and, you know, the alleged evacuation. You know, without, you know, some of these people like the Nade brothers and others, you know, you wouldn't have, you know, any insights into those, into the towers that day. And,
well, and it allowed it all not to be official, in quotes, footage, so that people would say, well, see, it wasn't, the government couldn't have done this. There were obviously independent bystanders who took pictures. Like, say,
just,
for instance,
just happened to be at the right place at the right time.
Right. Let's take, for example, Carmen Taylor. Carmen Taylor was a tourist in New York, and she happened to capture two very clear, perfect photographs of Flight 175 hitting just before and impacting the tower. Well, we looked at Carmen Taylor's story in great detail. And she was using, you know, because she's very proud to tell the story. It was a borrowed camera she borrowed to take to New York. This was 2001, so digital cameras weren't on telephones yet, but there were a lot of digital cameras, and at that time, the limit to the technology was storage. Her Sony Mavica camera was the type that had a floppy disk storage, and it takes approximately 3 to 4 seconds. I mean, this is a hard time. It's not possible for it to happen any sooner. It would took a cycle of 3 to 4 seconds for the camera to store to the floppy disk and ready itself to take another picture. And, of course, Carmen shows you the photo that she took on this Sony camera, and that's all in the newspaper article. Well, unfortunately, her two photos were far less than a second apart and completely impossible to have taken with the Sony Mavica digital camera in 2001.
At that time, yeah.
So it's what they did is the media, you know, took a lot of the footage that day and then they farmed it out to individuals, you know, who just claimed that they took it, you know, on their own.
More actors.
Right. And some of it, of course, was, you know, created, you know, pre-9/11. And I guess we could argue into eternity over, you know, what footage was and wasn't. But, you know, for the, you know, if for people that just want to understand what happened that day, you know, 9/11 was just simply a hoax. You know, from really the time that the towers went up till the time that they came down, they had minimal occupancy for, you know, 20, 25 years, first 20 or 25 floors. Other than that, there was a great expanse in the towers where we believe that most floors were never even put in to begin with. And, you know, then probably around 1993, when the first bombing happened at the World Trade Center, they cleared out pretty much everybody that was there, removed most of the other floors, and brought those buildings, you know, right up to where most buildings are when they come down, you know. Hollow, empty, gutted, you know.
And that's what you basically mean when you talk about the hollow towers theory. You're talking about most of this stuff is basically floors that weren't there, so whole sections that weren't in place that should have been there, and of course offices that have been pre-evacuated. So just about zero, so 10% tenancy. Do you have a figure, an official figure on the tenancy figures?
No, not really. But they were low. And if you think about it, if they had problems with getting people in the towers up until 1993, if they had had occupancy issues, and you're going to tell me that they, you know, had the terrorist bombing in 1993, where they claimed that the building came close to actually tipping over, and now from 1993 to 2001, people can't wait to get into the World Trade Center, and it becomes 100% occupied. I mean,
and keep in mind that, you know, suddenly commercial real estate in Manhattan was not in sudden demand either.
It just doesn't make sense. You know, so is what you're looking at is just a paper, you know, paper ghost trail. It's kind of like the carefully crafted aliases. Some of these, you know, carefully crafted aliases were created back in 80 or 85. And you would have recognized them only by seeing their name and address appear on a document somewhere where it was created the first time, when this person purchased a house in, you know, someplace in California, you know, and now this person officially exists because he purchased a house. Although,
and of course, one of those characters you mentioned in last week's interview, you mentioned about Edna Cintron, one of the characters was photographed waving in front of the towers, but right behind her was a gaping chasm. There was absolutely nothing there. Can you mention a little bit more about who is Edna Cintron to the audience?
Well, Edna Cintron was real at first. She came out, you know, and she was, you know, next to a column where, on the North Tower, where the plane, you know, allegedly went into the building. And the first thing that you notice, like you just said, is if you look at the picture carefully and put your emotion aside, you see nothing but a great big huge cavern behind her. We're talking about there's four or five floors above her that are missing. And, you know, I believe you can see below her as well. And there's just nothing there. As far as you can see in the building, there's no floor, you know. And, you know, you get the idea of, oh, you know, when you see that, like, wow, what are we looking at here? And at first she comes out, she's waving. And, of course, people assume it's Edna Cintron. It could have been anybody. But then later on, you know, she is still out there, and she's still, you know, waving, and she, this time, she catches on fire, and she just keeps waving, and she's, like, stuck to the beam there. The first time she came out, she was real. They put a stage prop up of her, you know, and she was supposed to be there for a long time for, you know, news crews to catch a picture of, and one of the news crews, you know, caught her on fire, and, you know, it's just kind of funny to a stage prop go like that.
Unbelievable. Oh, stick with us there, Phil and Larry. We'll be back right after this short message break. This is the People Speak Radio Show. I'm your host, Steve Johnson, talking with special guests Phil Dahan and Larry McWilliams, live on radio. And we'll be right back shortly with our guest and audience questions after this short message break.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
With over 150 million registered users, Pal Talk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 Pal Talk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining Pal Talk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
Today's school libraries are filled with endless opportunities. With access to print and digital materials, the latest technologies, and the guidance of a school librarian, our children are empowered with the tools they need to succeed in school and beyond. I'm Julianne Moore. Join me in celebrating all of the ways that school libraries and librarians are transforming learning for our students. For more information on how you can become involved, visit the American Association of School Librarians at aasl.org.
This land is your land.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak, every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern, on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you.
You're listening to the People Speak Radio Show, coming to you live across America and across the world. I'm your host for tonight, Steve Johnson, and we're back with our very two special guests. They're independent 9/11 researchers and done a massive amount of research into the Hollow Towers facts. Welcome back there, Phil and Larry.
Thank you, Steve.
Good to be here.
Excellent, excellent.
Where were we?
We have a question. Go ahead.
What were you going to say, Steve? I didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh, we have a question from Pete in Alaska, wants to know, do you guys know much about Giuliani's role and Bernard Kerik?
Well, I know, it's kind of funny, we touched on the 1993 bombing, but that was, you know, a hoax as well. And what's kind of funny is Bernard Kerik, they used a picture of Bernard Kerik in one of the pictures of the 1993 bombing. I know Giuliani, I know Larry knows a lot more about that. You know, go ahead, Larry.
Well, I you know, the one thing to say about Giuliani is, of course, he was integral to the planning. He was the mayor. The fire department was involved. Obviously, the police department was involved. Many, many aspects of city government. The coroner's office, of course, was seriously complicit. We can get into that later. But Rudy was, again, playing a very careful role. And again, back to the debris pile, one of his most important roles was on the morning of 9/12. Stephanopoulos, as well as Rudy Giuliani, are on the television the next morning, answering the question that no one was asking, that essentially going on and on about how small the debris pile was and trying to explain it away, trying to make sure everybody understands that they had 137 dump trucks hauling all through the night, hauling debris off. Well, now look at that for a second. Here Rudy's telling you they've been hauling debris off. There are supposedly, you know, 3,000 people in that debris pile, and it wouldn't be ridiculous to assume that some of them may even be alive, correct? And
wow.
Yet they're loading things onto dump trucks and hauling it out this very same day. You know, Rudy is begging a question that, by the way, no one has asked at that point, but they're careful to try to already start explaining away before someone asks why the debris pile is only 50 feet tall and it's not in the basement. Where did it all go?
Right, right. We have a question from Mike in California. Is it true or not, was Rudy Giuliani caught being a transvestite at one stage?
I think that picture might have been taken at a costume party.
Okay.
I don't really know much about it. More about it other than that. I mean, are we talking about, is he still on the phone?
No, it's just a question from the chat room.
Oh, okay. I think he's talking about, there's only one or two photographs. I think it might be only one of Giuliani in drag. And, I mean, what's your take, Larry? You think that's a costume party?
I think it was a costume party, and again, another thing to send people running around in circles. You know, Rudy Giuliani was certainly involved, and he was certainly playing a role. There's no question about, and still today, is doing such, and doing quite well at it. Of course, he's become very wealthy off of airport scanning machines and other such things that he's been allowed to cash into after playing his role essentially in the 9/11 hoax.
So, we have a question from Sam Hain in Firetown, Ohio. You guys all sound like conspiracy theorists. Is that what you are?
Oh, I don't know. That's kind of a harsh thing to say, isn't it?
Well, unfortunately, we have very few theories. Mostly, we're presenting facts that you can weave together however you like. You know, most of the things we've discussed this evening aren't theoretical. I mean, they are. Alice Hoglund is a fact, and her behavior on Larry King is a fact. The space that you see behind Edna Cintron is a fact. Carmen Taylor's the impossibility of Carmen Taylor's photographs is a fact.
Right, it cannot be refuted.
No phones and computers in the debris pile is a fact. No desks, no chairs. Let's go through that list really quick, because, you know, we should always center our conversation around, you know, because that's where all these theories, you know, and some really wild theories grew up out of, the debris pile. You know, no computers, no dust, no chairs. I mean, really, we're told that these buildings were full of 50,000 people, 25,000 per building. We're not talking about WTC-7 here. I'm talking about 1 and 2. And you've got, what, 40, 50,000 desks, and they're not in a debris pile? You got 50,000, 60, 70,000 phones, probably, and they're not in a debris pile? I mean...
No, nobody's ever asked that question, though. They just hauled it away under national security.
No, they weren't there. I mean, you can look at the pictures. It wouldn't be, you know, you couldn't hide it because they were evenly layered, you know, like a birthday cake all the way to the top. You know, you got a floor, then you've got desks, chairs, ceiling tiles, you've got phones, and, you know, all those things. And on top of that, you would have 50,000 of those plastic hard mats that the chairs roll around on. They don't really the carpeting.
I mean, 50,000 office desks and 50,000 office chairs.
There'd be 2,000 fire extinguishers. These things would be all through the debris pile. You could look at any picture and see them.
Rubber trash cans.
This is the stuff that Giuliani and his crowd and his network were afraid of. This is why Giuliani came out on 9/12, you know, and said the things that he did. And that's why Stephanopoulos on 9/13 around lunchtime did the same thing, you know. And they were... you know, had spent a lot of time before 9/11 being worried about, you know, just that none of that stuff was in the debris pile.
Here's a good example, Steve. There would have been over 210 acres of floor pans. That is the pans that sit on top of the trusses that the lightweight concrete would have been poured into to construct the floors. There would have presumably been more than 210 acres of these floor pans in the debris pile. There's a thread on Let's Roll Forums, it's easy to search up on Google, where we essentially put out the challenge, hunt the floor pans. And having pored over all 10,000 of the photographs that NIST has provided and looked at every one in careful detail, maybe Phil knows the number, I think we might have identified maybe 3 or 4 floor pans.
No, I think it got as high as 13.
Oh, did it? Okay, so yeah, there must have been a few found.
Yeah, I mean, I think we found 12, 13 floor pans.
Well, and a lot of those were, you know, gimmies of things that might have looked like crumpled up floor pans, and we went ahead and said, oh, well, it could have been, so we'll count it.
Now, the things that hold the floor pans up are trusses, and there was two types of trusses on the World Trade Center. There was a long truss and there was a short truss. The long truss was, I believe, 58 feet long, and
yes. The
short truss was, I believe, 38 feet long. And you had a combination of these on the floors according to the way that the interior was set up. And you had 46,600 of these trusses that were either 58 feet long or 38 feet long. And those also are completely absent from the debris pile. You can find, you know, a bunch of them down in one area of one photo. I think there was, you know, 20 or 25 of them, and you can clearly see that they're trusses. But, you know, it begs the question, what happened to the other 46,635 of them?
Wow.
I mean, you know, they're indestructible. They're just, you know, molded steel rebar.
We have another question here from Bruce in Michigan. He would like to know, what do you guys take on Killtown's research? He was a researcher from the early days of your Let's Roll Forum, did a lot of stuff into the actual towers themselves. Do you know much about Killtown's research and what he found out about the black boxes of Flight 93?
Well, I can start by saying I'm one of the few people that have ever gotten to talk to Killtown on the phone. You know, he raised me a few times, and, you know, we had a few discussions, and getting a hold of him on the phone is about as hard as getting Batman on the phone. He's been kind of a fun individual in 9/11, and, you know, Killtown's website is great if you want to, like Larry was talking about earlier, he's got so many facts there. And you can look at Killtown's website as kind of like a catalog of all the, you know, different facts where all the 9/11 theories grew out of. I mean, it's a great body of research. I can start by saying the last time I talked to him, you know, I asked him directly about our research and his views on 9/11. And, you know, he did say that as far as he was concerned, it's the best theory of all. You know, just the fact that the towers were hollow, empty, gutted, you know, with no people inside when they came down, and, you know, that the entire day was a hoax. Other than that, I know that Killtown liked Flight 93, and, you know, he hammered that into the ground. You want to add anything to that, Larry?
Yeah, that was a good pun. He hammered Flight 93 into the ground. I like that. But, and he has some interesting a few interesting things on the Pentagon that you don't find other places, and of course, you know, he has posted over the years quite a bit of Let's Roll Forums, for sure.
Are there any researchers you want to give a shout out to, their research and stuff that you found that deserves mention, for sure?
There are so many, Steve.
There's a couple that I can think of. I wouldn't know how to get to their website. Some of them, Brad from the Batcave, you know, had a lot of interesting stuff. But I mean, as far as like sources, you know, source material for, I mean, good stuff. I mean, it'd be like trying to tell you how to go to the right church.
Oh no. It's that divided. Are you telling me that 9/11 truth factions off into that many different rabbit holes? It's just impossible to navigate.
It's a toxic atmosphere. Let's put it that way, Steve.
Gosh,
well, it's the Tower of Babel strategy, Steve. When, you know, they knew that questions would come and they knew that people would ask them eventually, and so the strategy seemed to be, you know, get out there with a world of shills each, selling a slightly different rabbit hole and a slightly different brand to produce endless arguments and confuse anybody actually trying to seek the truth. And as I've said, the only thing uniform amongst all of them is they want you to make sure you believe that 3,000 Americans died in those towers.
Goodness me. When you believe that the figure is a lot less than that, when you consider that most of them were plants or setups by the lettered agencies, is that correct?
If we would like to go along with what the New York City Coroner's Office produced for 9/11, there was one real death certificate issued on 9/11/01 from the New York City Coroner's Office.
What?
The rest were provisional, which meant they didn't come with the standard reports, photographs, autopsy evidence, et cetera, and so on. All of the other deaths, am I correct, Phil?
I don't remember, to be honest with you. I know what you're talking about. I do remember it was extremely low. I can't remember a number, but...
I think it was one, but it certainly, well, of the 2,800 supposed deaths, I think they issued, I can't remember the numbers, it's been so long since I've looked at it, but it was in the hundreds, 700 or 800 or something, provisional death certificates, and the others were just declared missing.
Somebody in the chat room wanted to know, what happened to the actual steel? I remember it got taken away to Fresh Kills, got sifted. But what actually happened to the steel from the towers? Did it end up in China or somewhere else?
What steel?
From the towers.
Well, you know, who knows? I mean, let's say, you know, you could answer the question. What would it prove? I mean, you know, we talk about rabbit trails, and then, you know, there's some trails which, you know, rabbits shouldn't even bother going down.
Right, I mean, right.
You know, I
well,
mean...
The only point is it's not available to examine. That's the only point, that it's not available to examine. And like the Murrow Building, that was made a certainty very quickly afterwards. But I mean, even if it were here, I don't know what it would prove.
They peeled the you know, buildings like bananas. You know, that's the way that they fell. You know, everything fell out outside of its footprint.
Things exploded out of that tower.
It wasn't a controlled demolition. It was, you know, rather an uncontrolled demolition. Controlled demolitions also fall in their own footprint. This fell outside of its footprint. And,
right,
you know, like we said, if you had 50,000 phones in the World Trade Center, they'd be dangling from broken windows, and they'd be impaled in car windows below.
Street lamps.
They'd be everywhere. If you had 1,300 people above the 91st floor in a North Tower, say, South Tower falls first, then the North Tower, you know, falls, and you have 1,300 people trapped up there, you're going to see heads in the street and in windshields and arms, and you're going to see body parts, you know, pretty much everywhere. I mean, that's a lot of people. Those people are going to be at the top, and, you know, you can't claim that they're going to get crushed by the great weight of the building because they're at the top. So when they come down in the debris pile, they should be on top. You know, but they're missing too. I mean, you know, they said a lot of things on 9/11, and a lot of them are contradictory, but... You know, the pictures aren't. When you look at all the pictures, you know, all those things are absent. You have the phone, the chairs, desks, computers, people, you know, the stuff that people wore. It's just not there. Now, you can make silly theories for this stuff and say, well, you know, new weapons destroyed this stuff and turned it into dust on the way down. You know, or you can, you know, ask the logical question. I mean, if it's not in the debris pile when the buildings are done coming down, then it probably wasn't there to begin with. I mean, it's just logical. It's not a hard, you know, there's no reason to make this into a brain teaser.
Did you guys hear about Zim Shipping Company that moved out of the towers just beforehand?
Is this one of the Israeli things?
Yeah, well, Zim Shipping Corporation just moved out of the towers just beforehand, and they were connected to something Israeli, I remember.
Yeah, there was, you know, a lot of activity like that.
The real question would be, was them shipping ever actually in the towers, or were they an intelligence related front who pretended to have offices there, again, to give the impression that there really were people there and that some people in the know got to move out beforehand? This is a narrative that they had to do things like that to create. I mean, that's how you create a narrative like that. Well, there were people left behind, but this company was connected and they got out. But, you know, again, the financial companies who occupied those buildings were all related to the intelligence industry. They were what brought down the Soviet economy and brought down the Iron Curtain directly. They were the very companies that were used.
I think it was in the South Tower. Mm-hmm. I think 78th floor, Fuji Bank, if memory serves me. It was part of the impact of the alleged airliner, you know, 175 going into the tower. But, you know, the Fuji Bank that it crashed into was the same bank, you know, an office that had wired bin Laden money in Afghanistan under when he was calling himself the Mujahideen. It's ironic. You know, when you see these ironies happening, you know, you have to ask yourself, I mean, why the coincidence? I mean, like Larry said, it's part of the narrative. You know, bin Laden was getting, you know, treatment for dialysis or something with his kidneys, and the FBI visited him, I think, in what, Qatar or United Arab Emirates, I can't remember. But I'm sure it's another meeting that, you know, never happened. You know, it just took life once somebody wrote it down and said it did.
So who in your mind, your guys' mind, Larry and Phil, this is a separate question to both of you, who in your guys' mind were the masterminds of 9/11? It sounds to me like it was the Project for the New American Century, PNAC, or maybe even the Carlyle Group. Do you think it was anyone important like that, or maybe right at the top, the Rockefellers or Rothschilds?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, as we touched on last week, I mean, the history goes directly back to David Rockefeller's insistence that Radio Row be raised, and the World Trade Mart towers, that's what he wanted to call them, the World Trade Mart building or towers would have to be erected. You know, it goes directly back to David Rockefeller as being the guy who rolled up his sleeves and made the project happen from the beginning. Now, whether you can believe he's the mastermind or whether you think he might work for other interests, but it certainly does trace directly back to him in 1958 and the beginnings of the project. And since the co-chair of the 9/11 Commission says that it was a 30-year conspiracy, and he was just off by a year or two.
Mm-hmm. No, a little more than that. Well, 50. You took it back to 58 last year, but you know Rockefeller was talking about the World Trade Center in the late 40s.
Right.
You know, I mean that's really, you know, if you want to go from concept, you know, or to actual groundwork to lay the foundation, you know, it's splitting hairs. I mean, Rockefeller or Rothschild. I mean, is there really a difference? You know,
but certainly, probably since the post-World War II era, the plans were well underway.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And they've utilized every tentacle of the octopus ever since.
40 years and trillions of dollars to spend, but yet people say, oh, it's just impossible. But give me 40 years and $1 trillion or two and see what we can do.
There's one big question that many people ask, especially when they're confronted with this 9/11 truth like you guys are presenting, is like, if there were people on the inside, they would have come forward. Have there been people come forward and whistleblown about what their experiences and with actual evidence and proof? Have you heard of any such people like that?
You mean people coming out and saying that 9/11 was a hoax?
Well, actual whistleblowers that were on the inside, because they say that if such a thing were to be undertaken, they would need thousands and thousands of people. So surely somebody must have come forward. Have there been people come forward?
I think that's a false premise to begin with, though, because it didn't require thousands and thousands of people. It required a very limited number of actors for witnesses, a very limited number of actors for family members that we've seen. That number's less than 100, when there should have been 10,000 family members screaming and yelling. We see the same handful over the years over and over again. It required a very small number of people to build this illusion. It didn't require thousands and thousands.
Right.
You know, again, a small detail at the World Trade Center to make sure people rode the elevators to the top and to the bottom and not in between. And then the rest is just story and myth building. It wouldn't necessarily have required hundreds or thousands of people.
Well,
so therefore, you don't have this great exposure.
Well, let's say it did. Okay, I mean, there's a big difference between what is being, you know, proposed here. If 9/11 was a conspiracy to murder 3,000 people, okay, I think the answer to your question would be, of course, there would have been a lot of whistleblowers that came out, credible people with probably credible proof.
But couldn't have gone along with murder.
If 9/11 was a hoax, and let's say you got paid $450,000 to partake in it to some extent or another, I just couldn't see where there'd be too many people that would step up to the plate. You know, I mean, let's say they paid these people. Let me show you what the budget for 9/11. $32 billion for the Business Compensation Fund and $7 billion for the Victims Compensation Fund, both of which were completely absent in the World Trade Center when they came down. So they basically start themselves with a $39 billion budget. If you gave away $450,000, it would take 86,666 people before you're out of money. So, I mean, let's say you could buy yourself a witness or somebody who'd play along, you know, for $2 million, and you pay them $500,000 up front, and then you give them $1.5 million golden handcuffs, you know, end of contract 10 years later, you know, and they have to do certain things, keep their mouths shut, you know, and play by the rules. And then there's, you know, one more golden handcuffs 5 years later or 10 years later, and probably little perks through life. So let's say it's $3 million a person that they bought.
Wow.
People would be lining up for something like this.
Well, listen, thanks very much for being on the show today, Phil. And thanks very much, Larry.
My pleasure.
My pleasure, too. It was fun being here. You want to do some more shows in the future, Steve?
Definitely do. Yeah, we certainly have to catch up again, especially with the stuff that you guys are researching. There's a lot of work out there on your websites. Thanks very much for being on the show.
Pleasure being here.
Stay tuned for special guests Luke Radowski and Miko Peled coming up soon. Big thanks go out to the producers Mike, Doug, and Donald, to all my friends throughout the world, and all the guys that give me so much support. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. You can you tune into my own YouTube channel called Stop Funding Israel. But for me for now, take care and bye until next time.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people and they stood there hungry and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.